This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Dr. Trudy Parsi. It's been a while since we've talked. He's a professor at Georgetown University, author most recently of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Democracy, of Diplomacy. Excuse me. Trita Parsi, TRITAPARSI.com is the website. You can tweet him at TParsi. Dr. Parsi, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am looking at what's going on with the situation with Iran and John Bolton and Donald Trump and the Trump administration. And two things pop out at me, and I know that you've written about these, and I'm curious if there are, you know, more than just these two that concern you. The first is the probability that by increasing sanctions and making things worse for the Iranian people, that rather than bringing down the mullahs, if they're successful in their internal media strategy at convincing people that the United States is punishing them rather than their own leadership, it'll solidify their role, and the threats of war will do that as well. And then the second is that if we cut off all these oil exports from Iran, then Iran has said in the past, if you do this, we're not going to let any oil go out of past the Straits of Hormuz. And if that's the case, then we're in war with Iran, are we not?
Absolutely. I mean, the Iranians have been making this threat in the past that they would close the Strait of Hormuz if they cannot export their oil. Either everyone can export their oil or no one can. And I think there were good reasons to not take that too seriously, because at that point, when they were exporting their oil, if they were to do so, they would harm themselves immensely. But we're now, for the first time, looking at a scenario in which they may actually not be able to export their oil because of Trump's measure. And as a result, their threat of closing the strait needs to be taken much more seriously. Now, war games in the Pentagon have all shown the Iranians can close it, but they cannot keep it closed for more than 2 weeks because the U.S. military would intervene and would open it up. Mm-hmm. But it seems that the U.S. military would be in direct confrontation with Iranians in the Persian Gulf, and that means war.
How would that play out, in your opinion?
Well, based on everything we've seen, the Iranians are not going to prepare themselves for war with the U.S. in the manner that Saddam Hussein did. Saddam Hussein had a very strong standing army. A standing army of any other country, doesn't matter how strong it is, does not stand much of a chance against the U.S., U.S.'s standing army. Mm-hmm. What can be effective against the U.S., and which is what the Iranians have been focusing on for the last 25 years, is asymmetric warfare, in which they would most likely try to inflict as much damage as possible on the U.S. in the very early stages of a war, in which they would choose the battlefield. It wouldn't be the U.S. attacking Iran. The U.S. would do so, but then the Iranians would retaliate throughout the region and not allow the U.S. to have a veto on where the fighting would take place. Now, and their calculation likely would be to inflict so much damage on the U.S. as possible early on in order to break the U.S.'s fighting spirit, because if there's one thing in which the Iranians likely would be able to have a comparative advantage vis-a-vis the United States, is that they have far less casualty intolerance than what the U.S. does.
Now, unwillingness to lose soldiers, essentially, or even civilians.
Yes, they have a very high tolerance for that, whereas the U.S. has a very low tolerance, particularly right. Mindful of the fact that the public is not on board with this war to begin with.
The American public.
The American public. I mean, they're not in favor of this war. They don't even know that Trump is moving in that direction.
Right.
And in fact, for good reason, many of the people who constitute Trump's base chose him because he spoke out so strongly against the wars and was so critical of the Iraq war.
But if this was to play out in the way that you're describing with asymmetric warfare, the way that the British described George Washington's asymmetric warfare was terrorism. You know, the American soldiers were hiding behind trees and shooting the British who were coming in straight lines. If the news reports in the United States are that, you know, this proxy for the Iranians or that proxy or this group or that group or even the Iranians themselves committed these smaller acts with high levels of casualties, we'll simply call that terrorism, and that would galvanize American public support for an all-out war with Iran, would it not?
Well, the U.S.
And might that be what Trump is planning on, by the way?
I personally don't think so. Let me address what you said earlier on. The U.S. will call it terrorism, or the Trump administration will call it terrorism anyways, because they've already defined the IRGC as a terrorist organization. So they will be...
This is the Iranian military, basically. The Revolutionary Guard, yeah.
Revolutionary Guards, which is the strongest element of their national military. The administration will use that line. It will probably have some effect early on. But remember, even the Iraq War, at the outset, had 79% approval rating amongst the American public.
Right.
This will not have anywhere near that. And it will have no international support except for Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel. So I think the longevity of the American public's favorableness towards the war will be very short. In the case of Iraq, it lasted about a year and a half.
Right.
And then it turned. I think this time around it will turn much quickly because it will never be above 50% to begin with. This is a war that Trump is picking. This is not a case in which there can be question marks as to whether Iran has nuclear weapons or not, as was the case with Iraq. It's very clear they don't have nuclear weapons. They're abiding by a nuclear agreement that everyone else is in favor of as well. So it will be very difficult for them to sell this war, particularly to their own base,
right,
who are actually very much against these regime change wars and these foreign adventures.
But just kind of gaming this out, if the United States, you know, let's say Iran shuts down the Straits of Hormuz, we attack them or continue to attack them, they attack us in an asymmetric way, we call that terrorism, we go to war against them. Now you've got, you know, a U.S.-Iranian conflict, but as you pointed out, there's the Saudis, there's the Israelis, and the UAE, who are all, you know, aggressively opposed to Iran. In fact, the Saudis are, you know, one of their claims for the reason why they're bombing the crap out of Yemen right now is that the Houthis are aligned with Iran. It seems that if those actors, if Israel, which is a nuclear power, and Saudi Arabia and the UAE were to jump into this thing, you'd have a blown-up regional conflict. You've got Iranian ally in the president of Mr. Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. If Syria gets dragged into this thing, I mean, the Russians have an Air Force base and a naval port there. They're going to get in. We could be at war with Russia as a consequence of this. And it seems to me like it wouldn't necessarily be like a classic world war, because Europe is going to be standing on the sidelines going, this ain't our fight. But, you know, could this lead us to a war with Russia?
I think we'll have to take several steps before it gets into a war with Russia. But I think the idea that this will be a regional war that would involve many of the other countries and will involve Hezbollah and other actors is very likely. Because if there actually comes to a real military confrontation, the Iranian strategy is going to enlarge the war.
Right.
It's going to be to enlarge the war, because that's where they most likely have a capacity of being able to win the war, not in the sense of defeating the United States militarily, but in the sense of getting the United States to give up on the war.
Right, right. Giving us enough of a bloody nose that we pull out like we did in Vietnam. What about the Trump policy? So number one, it appears that the Trump policy is trying to drive us into a war. I personally believe that Donald Trump is doing that for the same reason that in 2010, when Barack Obama was president and at the beginning of the cycle for the 2012 election, Donald Trump tweeted out, expect Obama, I'm paraphrasing from memory, expect Obama to start a war somewhere soon because, you know, there's an election coming. So Donald Trump clearly knows that presidents during time of war are more easily reelected. This was something George W. Bush told his biographer in 1999, that if he got elected president, he was going to have a war with Iraq and he was going to make sure it lasted longer than his daddy's war did so he'd get reelected. And he did. So it seems to me that Trump is trying to do this as part of an election strategy. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Well, let's just stop right there. What are your thoughts on that?
I personally, this is my impression. I can't say that I have an insider information on this, but I actually don't think Trump himself actually wants a war. I think he is being fooled into thinking that this is an effective negotiating strategy.
Mm. But people like Bolton wants a war, doesn't he? I mean, Bolton's been cheerleading wars for decades.
Exactly. So Trump himself doesn't want it, I think. He thinks this will bring him leverage for a negotiation in which the Iranians capitulate. But Bolton, Pompeo, and Brian Hook and others in the administration, the people that Trump has surrounded himself with, they do want a war. And they realize that the sanctions path and the escalation path will get them a war. It will not get them a negotiation.
Wow.
And this is where they're essentially tricking Trump into believing this. And he's not probably a terribly difficult person to trick.
Yeah.
I do think he calculates that this will be good for his re-election. Remember, when he was saying that back in 2010, was before he ran his own campaign. And he ran his campaign very much against the forever wars.
Yeah.
And he knows that he has a lot of support in the public when he says those things, when he's critical of Iraq.
That doesn't mean
he may not change his mind and actually try to play that card. It could very well happen.
Yeah, we have just a little less than a minute before we're going to hit a hard break here. To what extent do you think it's possible that Trump might back away from that? I mean, how does this play out if Trump and his advisors are at odds on this?
In Syria, we saw that once he kind of got suspicious of what they were doing, he moved quickly and said, we're going to withdraw Syria. But then we also saw that Pompeo and Bolton were successful in walking that back.
You're right.
I mean, that's part of the problem that exists right now, that there's a president that has instincts that are suspicious of war, suspicious of regime change, but he has surrounded himself with neoconservative advisors who are just taking advantage of him and who are constantly pushing for much, much more bellicose policies under his nose.
Yeah, this is a remarkable issue that is not getting anything close to the attention that it should be in the American press. It just shocks me that it's not. Dr. Trita Parsi, professor at Georgetown University, thank you so much for being with us, sir. Great talking with you. His most recent book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. We'll be right back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. It's the Tom Hartman Program coming up on 18, well, it's a little past 18 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news and your calls in just a moment. And welcome back. Don in Linwood, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Don, what's up?
Oh, yeah. Since the right to be, I mean, you know, the right to vote has become a huge issue in the campaign for Bernie.
Well, I think it's a small issue, but but CNN certainly, you know, wanted to focus on it. Their producers, that was totally weird. They thought they could get a Michael Dukakis moment. Anyhow, back to you, Don. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're really coming after Bernie, and I have a suggestion. I think Bernie should double down and change just one word. And I think that if he changed one word and everybody fell in on it, it would make a huge difference. And that one word is not the right to vote, but we have the duty to vote. So even if you're in prison on death row, this would go for every single American citizen.
Right.
It's your duty to vote. And
Whoa.
Even if you were on death row, your last duty would be to vote in the name of democracy.
That's a huge reframe, Don. That's brilliant.
Thank you. That's all I had to say.
Okay. Well, I've been a chew on that for a while. In fact, I'm writing a book about the Republican war on voting, and that's a frame that I need to use. Don, thank you for that. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you, and very, very insightful. Wayne in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Wayne, what's up? Thanks for watching us on YouTube.
You're welcome. Thanks. I have a suggestion for breaking the executive privilege ban on the Mueller hearings.
Right.
I have, they want to get McGahn to testify first, but I'm suggesting they can break his ban and show his, you know, the weak bully that he is by inviting Mike Flynn and maybe Richard Yates. Because you remember a couple months ago, the sentencing judge for the Flynn trial said, Mr. Flynn, if you expect leniency, you haven't cooperated enough to the Mueller hearing or the investigation, and that you go back to the drawing boards and find ways to cooperate. And Chairman Nadler or Schiff can invite him in, so the judge can see that he's cooperating more with the Mueller report and ignore Trump's executive ban. And they could have him come in this week if they wanted to.
Well, Don McGahn is working for a private law firm now, and I think it's Jones Day. I could be wrong, but and in fact, it's a private law firm that Trump had hired to do some things, and he just fired a couple days ago because Don McGahn works there. So I would guess that McGahn would be just as inclined to want to get out in the public and speak his truth as Mike Flynn might.
Well,
I mean, I'm not saying that your idea isn't a good idea, but you know, I think McGahn is going to go along with this too.
Well, my point is that Trump has a blanket ban, and he thinks it's going to hold, and he's going to delay and drag his feet.
Right.
But they could ask Flynn to come this week, and he's worried about getting a stiffer sentence.
Right.
And I think that Richard Yates is yet to be sentenced, mm-hmm. and he's going to do everything he can to cooperate. And he could even mention McGahn in his testimony and further, you know, move the ball along and convincing the public.
Those are all good points, Wayne. Those are all excellent points. Hopefully some one of the Democrats is listening. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on 22 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Richard, in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Well, I was thinking about Attorney General Barr's history that's been mentioned, and something just came. I just read something in an old New York Times magazine from 10/14 of 18, and it turns out that Kris Kobach is another one of these players, you know, that sort of shows up with an agenda, and he apparently, after 9/11, was John Ashcroft's special helper regarding immigration. It was his advisor, and they came up with an immigrant crackdown, and they intended to deport 2,700 Somalians and about 14,000 Muslims. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of Ilhan Omar's comments, you know, that we've all forgotten about, right? You know, they just targeted Muslims after that. So,
right.
You know, Kris Kobach, not only, you know, doing what he's been doing about voters, has a history as a hitman like this Barr does, and they just sort of keep showing up every once in a while. And I think we just should add that to, you know, when we talk about this clown, you know, about his other history.
Yeah, the Kobach's other history. Yeah, Kobach also, you know, he's quite proud of the fact that he wrote, Senate Bill 1090 or 1024 or whatever, 10-something, in Arizona, the Show Your Papers, Please, that was so racist that it got overturned by the courts and you know, became actually an election issue in Arizona. And Kobach was the author of that thing. I mean, he's not even from Arizona, and he's writing legislation for the hardcore right-wing racists in the Arizona House and Senate.
Yeah, and well, they still get away with, you know, when she talked about how people did things, and then all the Muslims were attacked, and then you remember the Muslim center that the mainstream media said was a ground zero, and the Republicans went crazy, and it wasn't a ground zero.
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting. People are very sensitive about things that impact them, and I'd like to point that out, I guess, remind people and myself, when people are saying something, perhaps they have a bit more of a vested interest in the topic because they're the ones who are being targeted.
I would love to know when Kris Kobach went full racist, when he decided that his mission in life was to purge people of color and people who aren't Christians out of the United States and prevent them from having the right to vote. Do you have any insights into that, Richard?
Well, I have people in my family who are that way. I mean, they're
so maybe it's just he grew up that way.
Yeah, they're born that way. They just I don't know, they're just twisted. I just don't.
Yeah.
If we ever answer that, that will be Nobel Prize stuff.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I'm with you. That's, you know, it's like trying to understand the mind of a serial killer or something. Not that Kobach is a serial killer. He's just a serial vote suppressor. Richard, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And what do you think about Trump trying to twist out of having anybody who ever worked for him testify before the House and Senate? What should they do? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot on the table. We've been talking about war with Iran. Your thoughts on that, the possibility. What can we do to stop Trump from doing this? I mean, he clearly seems to be setting on that path. Donald Trump is saying that nobody who has ever worked for him at all, ever under any circumstances, can testify before Congress. I don't think this is going to hold up, but he thinks he can use the five Republicans in the Supreme Court to basically, you know, get his way. We'll see. Joe Biden's jumping into the race tomorrow. I mean, that's pretty much a certainty. So, you know, if you have any thoughts on that, that would be interesting to hear. But I wanted to start here with a little bit of geeky science. Yes, our geeky science alert. Washington State University researchers were trying to figure out, you know, glyphosate, right? This is the active ingredient in Roundup. And there's this whole big debate around glyphosate and what does it do and what, you know, who does it harm and how and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things they know is that, you know, glyphosate itself is apparently, or at least the thinking up to this point, it's toxic to bacteria. In fact, it was originally sold as an antibiotic. And it's toxic to plants, which is why it's sold as an herbicide. And literally hundreds of millions of pounds, maybe billions, I don't know, millions of pounds of it, let's say, are applied to the food. In fact, pretty much everybody in the United States has glyphosate in their bloodstream, measurable levels of glyphosate in their bloodstream in the United States because it's on so many of our crops. Other countries have banned it, not us. So these researchers were like, okay, how does glyphosate affect mammals? And so this was published in Scientific Reports last week. Michael Skinner and others, he's a professor of biological sciences at Washington State University. So what they did is they exposed pregnant rats between the 8th and 14th days of gestation to half the dose that they know shows no adverse effect. In other words, you start out with a dose that you know you can give to a pregnant rat, and it's not going to have birth defects, it's not going to hurt the rat. They cut that dose in half and gave it to the rats and said, well, let's see what happens. And, of course, the rats gave birth to normal pups. So, step one, cool. Then they bred those pups. And what happened in the second generation and the third generation? Well, this is where it gets shocking. The second, I'm quoting from this report at ScienceDaily.com, the second generation had, quote, significant increases, end quote, in testis, ovary, and mammary gland diseases, as well as obesity. Now, how long has glyphosate been in our food chain? Since about the 60s. In third generation males, the researchers saw a 30% incidence of prostate disease, three times the rate in the control population. And the third generation of females had a 40% increase in the incidence of kidney disease, four times the rate of the controls. Dr. Skinner is referring to this as generational toxicity. We've seen this with fungicides, pesticides, jet fuels, bisphenol A, the stuff that's in a lot of our plastics, and the insect repellent DEET, and the herbicide atrazine, the one that got outed by 60 Minutes years ago that caused all the problems with the apple crops. These are what are called epigenetic changes. In other words, these chemicals don't just alter biological functions, they actually change gene expression. And those gene expressions, those changes in our, those genetic changes, are passed along to future generations. This is shocking stuff. It's just shocking stuff. So, anyhow, there's that. Let's get back to your calls, though. John in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, three things are on my mind today, Tom. And the first is mail-in voting, repeal of Glass-Steagall, and Medicare for all. For mail-in voting, I've lived in Washington State, now I live here in the state of Missouri. We have been attacked. We're not just going up against Republicans in this election. We're going up against Republicans, Russians, Saudi Arabia, possibly Israel. So I am square for mail-in, vote by mail. right. because the ballot box is the post office.
Right. Oh, it works wonderfully. I live in Oregon. You don't
exactly.
need
exactly. Yeah. exactly. So the chances of ballots being stolen, you won't find in the back of somebody's car.
Right.
Like we've seen in North Carolina.
Yep.
All right. Second is Glass-Steagall. That was the worst piece of legislation ever.
Glass-Steagall? Wait a minute. Glass-Steagall said that a checkbook bank can't be a gambling bank, and a gambling bank can't be a checkbook bank. And it protected the American banking system from 1933 until, I think it was 1999 or 2000, it was repealed.
Exactly. And because of that, that's why we've had the banking crash. I truly feel
because it was
that.
Repealed.
Exactly. Because it was repealed, we need to put that back in.
Oh,
okay. I want that to be the Democratic platform.
Yes. Well, and Elizabeth Warren is certainly running on that. I'm not sure the position of anybody else. I know Bernie is in favor of bringing it back, too. He talked about that in this program for 11 years.
Right. We have to do that. And my last point is the Medicare for All. Now, hear me on this. I get my medical from the VA and also from my job. Basically, it's a public option. All right?
Right.
I get great care from the VA, you know, but from my job, the only thing I'm using from their health package is just for dental. I'm a cancer survivor. I didn't have to pay for the medication, this, that, or the other. The one thing I've always thought about Medicare was ever since I was paying into it since I was 16 years old, that's the only insurance that you pay for that you can't use until you got one foot in the grave. That never made sense to me.
Yeah.
I would rather pay twice, you know, take that out of my so I could get into Medicare. That way it would cover the senior citizens who are on it right now. But I would rather take the money that I'm giving to these private health care people, which really don't give you nothing, and pay twice for Medicare.
Right, pay that in taxes.
I can get in it.
Well, John Ball,
in taxes.
Excuse me, Robert Ball was the, Robert Ball was the guy who wrote the Medicare bill, or at least back in 1965 for Lyndon Johnson, or at least wrote most of it. And he's on the record. I wrote about this in one of my books. I'm pretty sure it was Rebooting the American Dream, but it might have been Screwed. But I have some extensive quotes from him. And he came right out and said at the time, he didn't say it to the newspapers, but he said it to enough of his colleagues that it got reported in the newspapers. He said, we're putting together a piece of legislation which we're selling and will get the Republicans to support by saying that we're going to save the health insurance companies money by taking their most expensive patients, people over 65, and having the government cover their cost. And in fact, that's how it worked out. The health insurance companies actually supported the passage of Medicare, which is why it passed, because it raised their profits. He said, but then he said, now once we get that into place, the next step is to lower the eligibility age by a decade every year over a 7 year period, and we will have covered everybody in America. And Lyndon Johnson was all on board with that Medicare was over time, and they figured it would probably take a decade or so, the American people would realize how well it worked and everybody would want to have it. And so they just start lowering the eligibility age as they were expanding the size of the Medicare employee, you know, I mean, the people who work for Medicare who could process claims and things, they would have to ramp up. This is why Bernie's Medicare for All has a 4 year phase in. You can't just do this overnight. And, you know, Robert Ball was like, this is the way to do it. And spot on. John, thank you very much for the call. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. I hope you're doing well, too. What's on your mind today?
I was listening to the earlier segment about Trump saying that the Supreme Court, he would go to the Supreme Court to have them intervene in the impeachment.
Right, if the House impeaches him, yes.
But constitutionally, he can't. Lawrence Tribe actually said already today that was idiocy. But, and Tribe, you know, is a constitutional scholar, Harvard professor.
Right.
The Constitution's quite clear. He can't, the courts have no role in impeachment.
Right.
Now, they can have a role in, you know, related issues like executive privilege, ruling on whether that's applicable, and probably on some of the subpoenas. You know, they ruled against Clinton in his impeachment, and they ruled against Nixon in his impeachment hearings.
Yep.
When they tried to use executive privilege. So, you know, even these guys, I mean, if they really are originalists or textualists, right?
They're not. I mean, that's just a scam, David. That whole originalist thing is
no,
a scam.
Of course I understand that, and Roberts is an institutionalist. But, you know, you only need one of the Republicans, and Roberts certainly has spoken out. He's no fan of the president, and he is an establishment guy, and he is an institutionalist, and you only need one of the
At the moment. God forbid something should happen to one of the other four Democratic nominees, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is hanging on. But
what?
Say what?
God forbid.
Well, if one of the other four Democratic appointees was to have to leave the bench for whatever reason, your death, infirmity, whatever, and Donald Trump got to appoint another, then he'd have six right-wing crazies on the court, and John Roberts wouldn't be able to stop them. That was my point.
Well, not just for the impeachment, but
for anything.
For all legislation.
For anything, right. I mean, you know, you would have a court that would be back like the Owens Court. During the early years of the Franklin Roosevelt administration. It wasn't until 1937 that the court started going along with FDR. They struck down piece after piece after piece of the New Deal. And, you know, when the stakes got really high in 37, when they literally had long-term unemployment insurance and Social Security on the docket and they were going to determine whether to strike those things down, that was the point at which FDR threatened them, and they backed down. And oddly enough, one of the justices who backed down was Justice Roberts back in the 30s, but Owens was the Chief Justice. But yeah, I'm very concerned about this. I'm also concerned about the fact that on some of these issues, the court may rule against Trump, and Trump may ignore the court's ruling. I mean, his hero, Andrew Jackson, did that twice. He did that with the Trail of Tears, and he did that with the Second National Bank of the United States. He simply ignored what the Supreme Court said and broke the law for the rest of his presidency. Abraham Lincoln did it once, although the circumstances were quite different. That was, you know, the Civil War. But this is something that, you know, I think people need to be paying attention to, and the Democrats need to get ready for. What happens if Trump says, okay, you know, the Supreme Court ruled against me, screw them. I'm just going to keep on doing what I'm doing. We're going to continue, you know, snatching kids at the border or putting them in cages or whatever it may be, right? You know, we're going to continue with this crazy war. We're, you know, fill in the blanks. We're going to keep on doing something that the Supreme Court says we can't. How will the Democrats respond? We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls in just a moment. It's 46, coming up on 47 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Albert in Festus, Missouri. Hey, Albert, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for letting me in. I just wanted to say one thing. I everybody sees the storm clouds brewing about war in Iran, and I think that if they keep pushing this, we're going to drive Iran into the hands of China. You know, because
I agree.
They're
already on the edge of an alliance with Russia.
Well, they already got deals with Russia, but they can't send their oil to them because we sanction in Russia. Of course, Trump's going to let it go through. So the next logical person to get that oil would be China, who needs all they can get.
Right.
And here it is being handed to them on a plate.
China's actually, you know, the two countries right now that are receiving the majority of the Iranian oil exports are China and India. And,
right.
You know, India's got Modi running it. Modi is a right-wing guy who wants to be a dictator. Although, you know, he's facing some electoral problems, but I think he's going to pull through. And China, of course, is not a democracy. It's a communist dictatorship. And both of them can, you know, relatively turn on a dime. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, but I think you're absolutely right, Albert. This could realign a lot of international politics and push us into a very, very tight corner.
Yep,
Yeah, we've been squeezed out.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. We're going to get squeezed out.
Yeah, particularly without the help of Europe, because Europe,
right.
You know, the European countries are all, hey, yeah, and Russia, by the way, and China, you know, hey, we cut this deal with Iran where they wouldn't develop nuclear weapons. They've been keeping the deal. We're not going to blow this thing up. Yeah, Albert, spot on. Thank you very much for the call. Laura in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hi. Well, I have two things. I'd like to comment on your talking about not doing your book reports and starting reading or explaining the Mueller report to us page by page. And also, I have a question. I love Medicare. I think it's wonderful. How will it work? Right now, 80% is covered, and we buy insurance for 20%.
Right.
So what will happen with that, with the 20%?
Under Bernie's plan, that 20% copay goes away. It's just 100% coverage.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love
Bernie anyway. You know that, and Elizabeth,
yeah.
my two favorite people.
Yeah.
And you're my third favorite person.
Bless you, Laura. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for being there. And I really like your idea about teaching us about the Mueller report. I think that would be great.
Yeah. In fact, I'm printing it out as we speak. I'm increasingly thinking that this is something that we should memorialize. We should just lay it out and lay out, you know, all the stories in it and the summaries and everything else. It just seems like it's time. And
yeah.
And doing it 5 minutes at a time, I think I could probably, well, I don't know how many days it would take. It might take a week or two. It might take a lot longer than that.
Well, that's great. You know? Or longer.
Yeah.
I don't care. Keep it going. It's wonderful. And then redo it again.
Right. Well, we'll have to find the parts that are not so, you know, technical that they're boring. But there's a lot in it that is not boring. So I think it's a great idea, and I'm looking forward to doing it.
I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay,
you've
got
you.
It. Laura, bye-bye. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Illinois, excuse me. Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's this war thing that I'm worried about. You know, if I recall, both Bushes got us into wars.
Yes.
Because they were having experience problems getting in so they could return to the Oval Office. Well, I think that's what this guy's doing it for.
I think so, too.
Political reasons.
I do. I think so, too. It's the same reason Ronald Reagan did his little war with Grenada. It's the same reason Maggie Thatcher had a war with the Falklands. It's frankly, I think it's the same reason that in the election of 72, Richard Nixon prolonged the war.
Oh, yeah. And what really gets me, Tom, all my fellow veterans, they should be screaming out about this stuff.
Yeah.
They're not nowhere to be found. When we got out, we were screaming about the Vietnam War. They should be screaming about putting us in yet another needless war that God only knows could lead us into World War III. So what I say, and I've said it many times, start the draft. You'll
yeah.
see how fast these people will drop that flag when their kids have to go pick up a rifle and go die in another country for a needless war.
I agree, Donald. And isn't it interesting that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump, all the guys who are pushing for war, they were all draft dodgers back in the 60s.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. These chicken hawks. I mean, God save us from the chicken hawks. You know, Doug Feith, Elliot Abrams, all of them were chicken hawks. Dick Cheney, every single one of them. Donald, thank you for the call. Glenn in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I had a question. On this collusion with Russia, did Hillary Clinton, did she not win the popular vote?
Yeah, by 3 million votes.
Okay, then how did they affect the election? If she won the popular vote, Donald Trump won by electoral vote, so it sounds to me like there was no collusion. She just lost because of the way our system's set up.
Well, you can make that argument, Glenn. You can make that argument. The thing is that Donald Trump won by 84,000 votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and about 20,000 votes in each one of those states, more or less. Each one of those states, number one, threw over 100,000 people off the voting rolls in the year before the election, mostly in minority neighborhoods. Number two, those were the three states that Paul Manafort reached out to a Russian oligarch and specifically said, we could use some help with these states. Number three, those were the states that were targeted with the ads and with the bots and the trolls and whatnot coming out of the Internet Research Bureau or agency out of St. Petersburg, Russia. And we don't know, you know, that we know that Saudi Arabia has a troll farm that works. We don't know if the Saudi troll farm was working on behalf of Trump. We don't know about any other countries. We don't know if China was running troll farms then. I mean, there's a lot that we don't know. Mueller's investigation only looked into Russia, and it really should have had a much wider scope. It should have tried to figure out what happened in our election. But Glenn, I'm very concerned about it. I think we all should be. Carson in Alexandria, Virginia. Hey, Carson, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I will take a little bit of issue with we don't know whether or not Saudi Arabia interfered with their troll farm on behalf of Trump. I think common sense will tell you that they did, but that's not my point. My point is, I think we can take a lesson from, I think his name is Frank Luntz, and the importance of semantics when it comes to elections. I really wish, and for those who've already self-identified as democratic socialists, I think the ship has sailed. I feel like socialism and socialist is too much of a loaded word for the average American for a Democratic candidate to label.
Carson, it is going to be a big lift, but if Bernie is the nominee, forgive my interrupting you, but we just have 10 seconds left here.
Sure.
I misread that. We have a full minute left. If Bernie is the nominee, Bernie has already identified himself as a Democratic Socialist. He's been calling himself that for 50 years. So if Bernie is the nominee, we're going to have to deal with that. If Bernie's not the nominee, then we're probably not going to have to deal with that because no other candidate has come out and said, yes, I'm a Democratic Socialist.
I much prefer progressive capitalist. I think that's a great.
Yeah, that was Pete Buttigieg's phrase, wasn't it?
I don't know whose phrase it was, but yeah. I think you're basically accomplishing the same thing as a democratic socialist. I just think from a semantic perspective, it's going to be much more effective.
I don't disagree with you, Carson. But like I said, you know, if Bernie's the nominee, that's what we're going to have to deal with. Mike in Hobe Sound, Florida. Mike, you got 20 seconds. What's up?
I'll be quick, Tom. If they do an audiobook of the Mueller report, I'd like to see you read it, as long as it's unredacted.
Okay.
My question is, why are we talking about Supreme Court picks for a president who has 12 investigations? I believe McConnell's justification was there's an important election coming up.
Yeah, well, there you go, except that it's Mitch McConnell who makes that decision. So I'm guessing that he will change his mind suddenly. He'll have an epiphany. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. It's an excellent point. I mean, the hypocrisy of it is an excellent point. And thanks, Mike, for listening to us on SiriusXM. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really isn't. It wasn't designed that way. It never worked that way. Without your participation, yes, you, without your participation, our democracy is weaker. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.